From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Reproductive justice and women's rights advocates are up in arms over a recent decision in Alabama by a county judge to give an aborted fetus the same rights as a person. A man named Ryan Magers of Madison County, Alabama, had learned that his girlfriend had a medication-induced abortion at 6 weeks into her pregnancy. Magers, with the help of an anti-abortion organization, petitioned to become the personal representative of the aborted fetus. And on Tuesday, the county probate judge Frank Barger granted his petition in the first such move of its kind nationwide. The case may also be one of the first consequences of a state constitutional amendment in Alabama that passed last year, recognizing the, quote, rights of unborn children. The Alabama case comes at the same time that the Trump administration has ordered the blocking of federal grants under the Title X program from Planned Parenthood and diverted it to faith-based organizations based on abortion access. Nearly two dozen states have sued the government over the drastic changes that are set to go into effect within 2 months. Trump's rule change could deprive millions of low-income American women of health care covered by government grants through the Department of Health and Human Services. My guest is Jessica Mason Piclo, Vice President of Law and the Courts at Rewire.news. She's also a writer and adjunct law professor in Boulder, Colorado, and the former assistant director of the Health Law Clinic at Hamline Law School in St. Paul, Minnesota, and a former litigator. Welcome, Jessica.
Thank you so much for having me back.
So let's first talk specifically about the Alabama case before we get to the broader attack, federally speaking, by the Trump administration. This case is bizarre. The fetus presumably no longer exists. It's, you know, at 6 weeks. You're talking about a collection of cells. What is the legal justification that this judge gave to allow the boyfriend of the woman in question to become the representative of an aborted fetus?
It's an excellent question. Presumably, the probate judge in this case is relying on the passage of Amendment 2 in Alabama, as you had mentioned, and that is a measure which prescribes constitutional rights to fertilized eggs, to embryos and fetuses as they develop, and equates them with full legal persons under the eyes of the law. So we anticipated that with its passage, we would see those folks who advocate for fetal personhood measures to not be satisfied and to take the next step and try to enshrine fetal personhood as a way to end legal abortion. And we are seeing those fledgling steps in this lawsuit now.
So this particular man, Ryan Magers, had, I guess, the help of an anti-abortion organization. And this is the kind of standard practice that a lot of these right-wing anti-abortion groups take. They find a case that they can get behind and provide the resources to litigate it and take it, you know, as far as they can. Ideally, they want to overturn Roe. They haven't made Roe versus Wade. They haven't made any secret about that. And now they have a Supreme Court that could potentially do that. So in Alabama, can you explain what happened? This woman obviously found out she was pregnant very early in her pregnancy, decided to terminate the pregnancy, as is her constitutional right, and she went to a clinic to do it. And her boyfriend now wants to sue this clinic?
Yeah, so we don't know very much about this case so far, but what we do know is both bizarre and completely disturbing. We know that a woman in Alabama had become pregnant and notified her boyfriend, Ryan Magers, presumably, although at this point we don't even have, you know, say, example proof of paternity. There's so many questions out there. But anyway, she notified him that she was pregnant and intended to terminate the pregnancy. And according to the court documents, and so we all really have only Mr. Magers' word at this. He tried to plead her and convince her to not terminate the pregnancy, but because it is a unilateral right, she carried out that right. Or again, this is all according to the court documents that we have filed so far. And that is not a crime. That is a lawful act that happens every day in America. But what does not happen is that we do not grant family members and those in relationship with pregnant people veto rights over their constitutional right to reproductive health care and to access it how they need to. And that's what this lawsuit is trying to do. So let's walk through how it's trying to do that. Mr. Majors went to a probate court and said, I would like to be the personal representative of my aborted baby. Now, there's so much wrong with this. One, as I said, we have no proof of paternity. Second, there is no baby at 6 weeks. There's not even really a fetus at 6 weeks. Where it's a collection of cells. It's an embryo at this point. And relying again on this amendment that had passed in Alabama that said this gives him the legal right. And a probate judge bought that. And so what that does now is allow Mr. Majors, as a personal representative of this aborted embryo, to assert a wrongful death claim against the clinic. And this is something that we really do need to walk through because he's, one, not suing the pregnant person, presumably his ex-girlfriend. I would be surprised if they're still together, given the facts of the case. But she is not a member of the lawsuit so far. He is suing the clinic and the manufacturers of the medication that she used to terminate her pregnancy. And he's claiming that it was a wrongful act. But legal abortion is not a wrongful act. And so the very premise of his lawsuit falls apart. And it also falls apart because a wrongful death claim requires the person asserting it to prove some sort of causation, right? That a specific act wrongfully caused the death. And again, abortion is legal in Alabama, as much as the pro-life folks may not want it to be. And so there is no wrongful act here. And by failing to sue the pregnant person, the very act of causation gets all mucked up. So that's a lot of legal weeds to wade through. And it is tempting to say, well, this is just Alabama, or this is just, you know, a one-off, and a court will do the right thing and dismiss this lawsuit. And I hope all of those things to be true. But what we have seen happen in Alabama is that the anti-choice folks in the state have spent the last 10 years working piecemeal to institute in state law fetal rights at the expense of the rights of pregnant patients. And they are relying on that decade of work now to carry it further. And so as much as this lawsuit is bizarre and seems like it should not be the kind of thing that gets replicated in other places across the country, we dismiss it at our peril.
So essentially, we have a collection of cells, and at 6 weeks, you may not even see a heartbeat. A heartbeat is often detected 6.5 to 7 weeks. But even if it were, she would still have the right to an abortion. But a collection of cells has been given the right to be a person. You know, just blows my mind. I mean, so the anti-abortion crowd has drawn the line at conception, where life begins, which of course there's been scientific debates around that. Most doctors agree that that doesn't make any sense. Why not sperm, right? Why not decide that men's sperm are alive then, and that they literally kill millions of lives every time they throw away a condom? but of course, that's generally arbitrary and linked to the rights of women as people or people capable of being pregnant. So your colleague Yamani Gandhi had written in Rewire.news about this particular case. And I'm wondering if you can give us a little bit of the historical backdrop that she wrote about, that a few years ago, about 5 years ago, Alabama had essentially had a similar case where pregnant women were criminally charged and convicted of chemically endangering their fetuses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Imani Gandhi has really been on this beat for a while, and her work in this area is outstanding. I highly recommend folks go and look it up, particularly as it comes as it relates to the cases of Hope Hicks. She is a woman, and Hope and Akram, I'm sorry if I'm misstating their names, but they were women who were prosecuted in the state of Alabama under this Alabama's child endangerment.
Sarah Hicks, I believe.
Yeah. Oh, Sarah Hicks. I'm sorry. Thank you for correcting me. Sarah Hicks and Hope Ankrum. Yes. They were prosecuted under the state's child endangerment statute for ingesting chemicals while pregnant. So they had pregnancies that actually turned out fine. But the state had used a statute that did not define, or that's, you know, a chemical endangerment statute that very specifically was defined to children, and expanded the definition to include unborn children at any stage of development. So effectively putting pregnant people on notice in Alabama that they would be criminally liable for the outcomes of their pregnancies. And this is a really dangerous precedent to set, because while some of these movements happen in sort of fits of legislative passion, there is a story that, you know, there's a tragic outcome, or we're seeing a lot of it in regards to the opioid epidemic now of children who are born with neonatal abstinence syndrome, for example. And so there is this push to sort of protect babies, but that was never the case in Alabama. They made it very clear that this push was to punish people, and that it would be pitting the pregnancy against the pregnant person against their developing pregnancy. And it's not a surprise then that we see those cases cited so forcefully in the lawsuit that we're talking about right now.
So let's talk about the national context. And we certainly hope to be following the current story in Alabama of this man claiming to represent his aborted fetus, or the aborted fetus of his girlfriend. But nationally, federally, you have this gag rule that Trump has essentially decided to change, where Title X funding cannot go to abortion clinics. I understand that simply sort of share the same facility, or clinics that offer healthcare that share the same facility with one that offers abortion. Can you explain that? You can probably do a better job than I can.
Yeah, so the rule is very complex, and you did an excellent job of giving an overview. Title X family planning funds go to, you know, clinics that used to offer comprehensive reproductive health care services, including contraception and abortion. And what the Trump administration has done is unilaterally rewrite those rules to do a couple of things. And they all, the rewritten rules all inure to the benefit of religious anti-choice advocates and not actual healthcare providers. So for the beginning, they gag doctors and providers, and that includes hospitals, from even mentioning the word abortion in the delivery of healthcare services. So that means that if you are a patient who is experiencing a miscarriage and you go to a public hospital that happens to accept Title X funds, they can't use the word abortion in describing the treatment courses for you. And so you may be experiencing what we call a missed miscarriage. And that's when you have effectively miscarried your developing pregnancy, but your body hasn't recognized it yet. And there are two known very effective ways to treat that. And one is through medication abortion early in the developing pregnancy. And the second is through surgical abortion if it's later on. So this is the kind of impact. That's part of it. Doctors and providers can't even mention the word abortion and refer patients for it. Then there is what you mentioned, the segregation of funds and facilities provisions. And that says that if you are a Title X clinic or you participate in the program, then you may not accept that federal funding if you share a space where abortion and abortion-related services are provided. So, for example, if you are a Planned Parenthood clinic that only offers medication abortions, you may not be able to accept Title X funding under those rules unless you siphon off that portion of your practice that provides medication abortion, put it in an entirely different facility, subject to entirely different staff reporting and oversight management, and then not accept any family planning dollars from the federal government in order to operate.
Wow. Okay, so you had huge pushback because, of course, you have millions of women that rely on health services that may or may not be related to abortion, that are in rural parts of the country and clinics run often by Planned Parenthood. All of this could be in jeopardy. Where does the president expect, and the Department of Health and Human Services through which these grants are given, where do they expect to divert that funding to? Are they expecting a crop of so-called faith-based organizations to be able to replicate the services that these other clinics provide and take on that burden?
I think that's an excellent question. I think that they are planning on diverting those resources to faith-based organizations, like you said, but I don't think they care whether or not those faith-based organizations actually replicate the services that are being lost here. I mean, this is very clearly an attack on comprehensive reproductive health care that members in the administration have a religious and moral objection to. And so they are quite insistent on placing that religious and moral objection on the rest of the country. So to the extent that there are clinics that could take up what Planned Parenthood or another independent clinic that offered comprehensive reproductive health care services and accepted Title X dollars did, I don't think they care. I don't think they care that those services will be lost and that patients will go without need. I think that's the point.
So 20 states and counting, I understand Pennsylvania has just joined them, are suing the government because this rule is expected to go into effect within 60 days. Do you hope that that gets delayed while it's being litigated?
I hope so. There's very good reasons why the court at a minimum should delay the rule while this fight gets litigated, if not block the rules entirely. At a minimum, the administration did no due diligence in terms of figuring out the cost and the effect and impact such rule would have. And the law very clearly says they have to do that. It is another example of the Trump administration ignoring norms of lawmaking to advance an agenda when they see the need and the opportunity. And we knew that the Title X rule was coming. It's no surprise with this administration. Reproductive rights have been squarely on their target and a top priority to roll them back as far as they can. I mean, Trump has said time and time again, only the judges that he nominates will be ones who overturn Roe. So none of this is a surprise. They are very clear about what they're trying to do. And hopefully the courts see that as the political maneuvering that it is and not actually doing any legislating in good faith when it comes to reproductive health care.
And of course, all of these are part of a multi-pronged attack on women's access to abortion, the state level attacks, the federal level attacks. Recently there was a law that the Senate thankfully voted down called the so-called Born Alive act that, just uses these propagandist terms like born alive, where essentially Trump slammed the Senate for voting down an act that he claims would have helped preserve the life or resulted in life-saving measures that doctors could take to keep alive a fetus that was aborted but still, potentially able to live. So much of it premised on misinformation, but the Senate voted it down. Can you explain to us what exactly this particular act was? And is it part of just more sort of a misinformation campaign rather than an actual thing?
It's absolutely part of a misinformation campaign. And this in particular is heartless and cruel. What the administration and Senator Saci in introducing this bill was targeting is a practice that is effectively perinatal hospice. And that is, those are measures that doctors take when a non-viable pregnancy has been delivered. And in some instances, that is through a termination. And this is the only process that happens. And there are methods that doctors take to provide palliative and comfort care through that process. And the family is very much involved in this. And so to take a family's grief and a family's pain and suggest that what Democrats are doing are aborting babies on the delivery table is not only morally reprehensible, but it's the exact kind of political rhetoric that gets patients and providers killed. Like, we are seeing an uptick in violence targeting abortion providers and clinics. We're seeing more and more legislators making it very clear that they would be fine locking up women who attempted to terminate pregnancies. And when we have the president of the United States and then Republican senators going on TV and echoing this rhetoric and then trying to legislate based on it, it is dangerous times. And it's not just, it's misinformation, but I think people should be morally outraged at the level to which Republicans are willing to politicize families' pain for their own political gains.
This is, so Republicans have created this idea and anti-choice, anti-abortion activists have created this notion of late-term abortions where they wait till the baby's almost, born and then they decide to kill the baby because doctors are committing murder. And in fact, there is no such thing as late-term abortions. Essentially, in the cases we're talking about, you have families have chosen to go ahead with a pregnancy, and near the end of the pregnancy, some debilitating condition becomes apparent where it's clear that the baby, the fetus, will not survive. And so the doctors have to come up with the parents for the best kind of culmination of this horrific tragedy that's unfolding, that presumably the parents are deeply grieving over. And the Republicans say that this is abortion and the doctor should do anything to keep alive this fetus, even if the fetus is gonna die and even if it endangers the mother's life, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, absolutely. And it's, you know, I think Democrats have not been comfortable for far too long taking a moral high ground when it comes to the abortion debate. And if there is ever an opportunity to take the moral high ground, it's with this nonsense.
You wrote in late February on Rewire.news about anti-choice Republican attorneys general going back to those sort of state-level attacks against the access to abortion, saying that anti-choice Republican attorneys generals are saying increasingly that states can force patients into riskier medical procedures. This is reminding me of the case in Argentina recently where an 11-year-old rape victim was forced to go through with a pregnancy engage in a terrible C-section, emergency C-section. You know, the Washington Post had this op-ed about how our Latin America's abortion laws are a form of torture. But I wonder that, you know, we here in the United States may be not too far off if some of these anti-abortion activists have their way.
Absolutely. I mean, what the anti-abortion activists did in Argentina to that young girl should absolutely be criminal. They forced her to carry a pregnancy that was the product of rape that she did obviously not want, but they forced her to carry it up until a point where they could try to get a viable fetus out of it. And so this was not only just tremendously dangerous to her. I mean, you mentioned it. It forced her into an emergency C-section because no one that young is able to safely deliver a baby, not to mention the fact that she did not want to be pregnant. She was raped by a family member. And it did not matter. We've learned that anti-choice activists met with this girl in the hospital. I mean, they were badgering her. And when we have then state's attorney general arguing to the Supreme Court that states have the power to force abortion patients into riskier procedures, which is exactly what they are doing in defending an Alabama law that attempts to criminalize one of the most safest forms of later abortion, that we are shades away from countries that we like to say our reproductive rights and health policy is evolved from, but it's not.
Yeah. Well, if we do have any one of these lawsuits going down to the Supreme Court, Jessica, finally, do you think that Roe versus Wade is in real danger this year or the next?
There is no question that legal abortion in the courts is at a precipice. And we know with the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh that there are 5 conservative votes on the court to, at a minimum, gut abortion rights and access and render it legal in name only, and quite possibly go so far as to overturn Roe and recriminalize abortion, kick it to the states if possible, in which case that is a nightmare scenario, even though we're not far from it. So I think that the threat to abortion rights in the federal courts is very real. And right now, when it comes to the Supreme Court, we have to rely on the will of Chief Justice John Roberts to see if he is not willing to go as far as his other conservative colleagues and overturn Roe entirely. I am not sure where he will fall ultimately when given the test.
Well, Jessica, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to Rewire.news from our website, as well as to the pieces that you and your colleague Imani Gandhi wrote. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Jessica Mason-Piclo is Vice President of Law and the Courts at Rewire.News. She's also a writer and adjunct law professor in Boulder, Colorado. And we've been talking about the multiple attacks on women's reproductive rights. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram at RU with Sonali.